From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I was bringing them the biggest ratings in the history of the Arab world. So they dropped the most popular show because at the end of the day, they don't care about the money. They're all part of the one big system.
Tickling Giants is a new documentary about Bassem Youssef, a heart surgeon turned comedian who's known as the Jon Stewart of Egypt. Youssef's satirical news program, modeled on The Daily Show, was the first of its kind in the Middle East and immensely popular until the military-backed government forced him off the air and out of the country in 2014. Youssef and Daily Show producer and Tickling Giants director Sarah Taxler tell us about the perils of producing satire in Egypt and why they were accused of being spies for the CIA. But first on the news banter, will the writers strike? Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter from New York this week. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, people in town are very worried. A lot of people who work in this industry, in the entertainment field, we want to know if there is going to be a writer's strike. And as we have reported, the Writers Guild is far apart from the studios right now. It's a negotiation, but they're looking at a $535 million contract over 3 years. The studios are at about $180 million, and this would be the cost across all of the studios to pay for the enhanced benefits that the writers are asking for. There is a strike authorization vote on April 24th, and then a strike could happen if things don't go the right way as soon as May 2nd. So some people are wondering, why are the writers upset when there's so much going on in entertainment right now? So I will hand it to you, Matt, to explain why the writers are upset.
That is a good question. But I think if you look closer at this so-called peak TV age that we are in with 500 scripted shows, and you say, well, you know, there's so much opportunity. Why are the writers upset about that? But those shows often will have 10 episodes, 12 episodes, not the traditional 22 episodes that network shows once did, and which, frankly, most of the writers' contracts are based on a universe in which there will be 22 episodes for a year. And now you have writers being held to year-long contracts or contracts that go for the length of production, but they're only getting paid on a 10-episode basis. So the actual revenue that a writer can make in a year hasn't really grown at the pace that the peak TV era would suggest. So that's, I think, contributing to this notion that contracts should be re-examined and perhaps adjusted to take into account for this new way that TV is being made.
Yeah, and of course, there was a strike 10 years ago. It was quite bitter and divisive, and it caused a lot of disruption. You know, the thing about TV especially is that writers become showrunners, and then they become sort of torn between their allegiance to the writers and their, you know, managing shows for studios. I remember last time, you know, John Oliver was a very vocal supporter of the strike, and people like, you know, in that position, they're going to be hit fast, these late night shows especially, because of the pace at which they go. If it happens again, I think it will also be an extremely divisive issue.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the way people consume entertainment now, most people are not watching scripted TV the moment it airs on NBC. They're either watching it on their DVR or they're watching it later on Netflix or elsewhere. So I think the real impact of a strike would be on these late night shows and the more broadcast network oriented shows. In my opinion, there would be less of an effect on the streaming services like Netflix, Amazon, even HBO, which can rely on its back catalog of shows where, you know, people might start re-examining a show they had never watched before because there's nothing new on. And I think the real hurt would come to these broadcast networks, especially heading into the fall season and the upfronts that are scheduled about 2 weeks after this prospective strike vote.
So we'll see what happens. I know that I saw something in the last few days suggesting maybe there's hope for common ground, and I know a lot of people will be hoping that there will be a successful resolution with no strike. Staying with TV for a second, well, sort of staying with TV, I should say, Cannes has announced its lineup. They are having TV shows. It's the first time they've had episodic television on display. Their special screenings at Cannes. The two shows are the Twin Peaks revival that Showtime is launching and the second season of Top of the Lake, which is called Top of the Lake China Girl, which is Sundance TV and BBC. They've shown long-form projects in the past. They showed, like, HBO's Beyond the Candelabra, although, as you pointed out to me earlier, that was shown in theaters in Europe. So that was a bit of a different form in Europe. But this, you know, it's kind of getting to what other places, you know, Sundance has started showing TV, too, and the lines are blurring in the era of streaming, I think.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not a secret that some of the most creative work being done right now is being done in television. But I think it is significant that the biggest showcase in the global film world, which is that Cannes Film Festival red carpet where everybody is all dressed up in formal wear and going up the steps of the Palais to see the premiere of their big film. Now there's going to be television there. I also think it's no coincidence that these two projects are from film-oriented directors. You have David Lynch with the Twin Peaks revival and Jane Campion with Top of the Lake, both of whom have had a lot of success in the types of films that go to Cannes. So I think, you know, it's just one more step towards television kind of ascending to the respect that it deserves now.
Yeah, and both Lynch and Campion previously have won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, so they have their bona fides in place. And let's just quickly turn to Bill O'Reilly. He's gone on vacation, which he has said is a scheduled vacation. Emphasis, scheduled vacation. And of course, in the midst of all the allegations of sexual harassment and Fox News investigation, the speculation is, will he or will he not return from this? Is this a permanent vacation or a temporary vacation?
You know, everybody has asked me to predict on this one, and it's hard to predict. There is a push-pull going on here where his ratings have not taken any hit based on the sexual harassment scandal and the women who have come forward and the payouts that Fox News has made. But there is a new order at the parent company of Fox News. The Murdoch sons are much less tolerant than their father of this kind of behavior. So if they want to make a statement and say this is a new 21st century Fox, a big way to do that would be to get rid of Bill O'Reilly. That's an easy thing for me to say when I'm not running a network that generates $1.5 billion in profits in the past year, but it is an interesting quandary.
I always find it interesting how we know the Murdoch family business as if we are somehow acquainted with them. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In June 2012, Egypt was in transition. Following the protests of the Arab Spring, ousted leader Hosni Mubarak was sentenced to life in prison, and Muslim Brotherhood candidate Mohamed Morsi became the new president. That month, Jon Stewart invited Bassem Youssef to appear on The Daily Show.
Welcome back. My guest tonight, he is a heart surgeon who also hosts a satirical news program in Egypt called Al-Burnamik. Please welcome Bassem Youssef.
The tale of how Bassem Youssef went from performing heart surgery to performing comedy, first on YouTube and then on live TV, is told in the new documentary, Tickling Giants. Youssef joins us today along with Sarah Taxler, the director of the film and a producer on The Daily Show, which is where she and Youssef first met. Following his Daily Show appearance, Youssef launched a show in Egypt with a very similar look, and it began to draw a much bigger audience than the American original. The Arab Spring made comedy a possibility, but satire in Egypt still was not without risks. In the film, we see Youssef watch news reports of his own arrest.
The Egyptian government appears to be cracking down on critics.
Egypt's prosecutor general has issued a warrant for Youssef's arrest.
They're saying that he has insulted President Mohamed Morsi.
Insulting Islam and President Mohamed Morsi.
That a comedian would be a wanted man is itself an astonishing thing.
I don't know if they're going to come and get me. And I don't want to expose my wife to that. I'm going to turn myself in.
It was a risk that Youssef could not have foreseen when he was practicing medicine. But back then, even the idea of becoming an entertainer seemed far beyond his reach. So when you are a heart surgeon in the Mubarak era, are you thinking, gee, I sure would like to make comedy, but they would kill me? Or are you just not even thinking that?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of thinking would be the same fantasy that you would have if you would acquire superpowers. I want to fly, or I can throw webs from my fingers like Spider-Man. It's like, yeah, it doesn't leave the fantasy chamber.
Right. So then he falls. And I want to know how you just get from, I'm a doctor who wouldn't dare, to I am a doctor who's becoming a comedian who does dare.
I still played it as a doctor very safe. I was just filming these YouTube videos in my apartment with my friends who are more experienced in YouTube than I was, and I was just like the face of it. And I would still maintain my work as a doctor. I was still going to the hospital, doing my shifts. So at that time, there was not a decision that I'm going to drop everything and do comedy. It was something on the side. And I thought at that time, maybe in a couple of years, somebody will discover these episodes and give me a job. And I will do that on the side as being a doctor. And then it took me another year of television doing a very small show until I had to meet Jon Stewart. And then it took me another year of a live show to make me decide, all right, I'm going to just leave medicine and
so gradually
and be that. So yeah, it was not really sudden.
It appeared to me watching your film that you are watching Jon Stewart in Egypt and that people in Egypt know Jon Stewart and are into Jon Stewart. Was that like a little subculture or you? Or
it was a sub of a sub of a sub of a subculture.
It was a mini culture?
People who watch Jon Stewart were a minority of a minority. First of all, you have to understand English.
Yes.
Not just that. You have to understand the references because you had people who would understand Friends but would not understand Frasier. And that was me in the 1990s and 2000. And then it took you a little bit of time to understand what Frasier is because it's a little bit more sophisticated.
Frasier, the sitcom you're talking about.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then it took you a little bit more to understand what does it mean to be a political satirist because people who would watch Jon Stewart, they have to understand what is Democrat, what is a Republican, what is Fox News. So they would, or else you would be lost.
Right.
And I would claim, like Trevor Noah would claim, that people in my country knew Jon Stewart through me. Trevor Noah said the same. People in South Africa didn't know who the hell was Jon Stewart.
Right.
When he started to be on his show, people knew him.
Right.
When I started to come on his show, people started to subtitle Jon Stewart shows on YouTube with Arabic subtitles.
Wow.
Yeah.
So at what point do you decide that you're coming to meet with Sarah, who is, well, I came to meet Jon Stewart and observe how Jon Stewart did his show?
That was after the first season of the small show that ended 2012. And we came in the summer of 2012 and we wanted to see how Jon manages a live show because we never had something like this in Egypt. We didn't even know what does it mean to have live audience in the studio, live audience that are not paid to laugh or clap. What is the process?
Right.
So I came with my producers, with my writers, with people that worked with me in the first season because this was the Albernamic 2.0. We wanted actually to be a real life show. And people were very skeptic because he's like, you're never going to do it. Nobody does that in the Arab world. And we came and we wanted to speak to not just Jon Stewart, but his team. We wanted to understand. For me, I wanted to meet Jon.
Of course you did. So do I.
But for me and the rest of the team to do the show, we know that Jon is not going to be the one who would answer our question. It will be the team. This is why we started to hang out with the producers. Sarah was one of the producers, and we started to ask them, how do you collect your information? What happens in the writing room? We started to attend the production meetings, and this is how I met Sarah.
And so by then you had assembled some kind of a team, but you didn't have a big pool. I don't even know if political satire was a thing in Egypt. I mean, I can't imagine in the era of Mubarak you had a lot of political satire.
Not just that. We didn't have political satire. We didn't have the idea of having people working for a show, working full-time. All of the TV shows were just something that like a journalist will do as a part-time, will just like have some sort of a headlines of the news and just like throw it there. But somebody actually to write for a show, we didn't even have this. Somebody who would be dedicated, we didn't have this. All of the talented writers would be out there writing TV comedies or movies. And this was a difficult for us when we would tell them, you're going to come to work with us full-time. It's like, that's not going to happen. So we started to come up with our own team, people just fresh out of college, or lawyers or engineers, people who didn't actually have writing as a profession.
And they were like, what the hell, I may as well do this.
I mean, I'm a doctor, what the hell, I became a host, so why would it be any different?
And then, so you, what was your role at The Daily Show?
I'm a senior producer. I've been there since 2005. And at the time, I was also...
Still to this day?
Still to this day. So I'd been there when I met Bassem. It was 2012.
Yeah.
And he and his team just were hanging out in our department. And I couldn't imagine, just in talking to them, Boston was still a doctor at the time, and I couldn't imagine John Stewart doing heart surgeries during the day and then coming to work. So that was very interesting to me. I obviously didn't know that the show was going to become this huge hit at the time because it wasn't a live show yet. And I got the idea that Boston was a great character and it would be a really interesting film. But I was kind of scared to go to Egypt, but yeah. I didn't want to let the opportunity pass. So at the end of the day we met, I asked him if I could make a movie and he said yes.
Little did you know.
Little did I know. Neither of us had any clue.
So then the show goes on the air. And it's this gigantic, I mean, I don't know what the population of Egypt is.
90 million people.
So 30 million of these 90 million are watching your show.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Well, when the show would air, the streets would be absolutely empty.
Wow.
It's like the Super Bowl. Nobody's in the street.
Everyone just would go to cafes and they would have TVs playing. And it was a very communal experience, which I've never seen with comedy anywhere else I've ever visited. Like I've seen it for sports.
Right.
This is the only time I ever saw it where it was people getting together to watch a show and laugh and talk about politics.
And of course, Morsi is standing up. He is Muslim Brotherhood, but he's telling people, I'm not going to repress anybody's speech.
Mm-hmm.
So for how long is the run that you have where life is good that way?
No, I mean, I had a good run throughout his presidency. I mean, I have to be honest. I mean, yes, I was taken in for questioning, but they couldn't stop my show.
What do they ask you?
Why are these jokes funny? Which is the worst thing that you can ask a guy.
That's a really terrible question.
Yeah, I mean, because I was accused of insulting the president, insulting Islam, spreading rumors, and disturbing the peace.
And you had to help them play the videos to prosecute.
I went there. No, they had like all my episodes. The episodes in question were on CDs. And they have to put it on an outdated Windows 95 computer. It was an ancient computer, and and they have a problem working the CDs. And after 20 minutes of them trying to work, I got bored, and I stood up trying to actually to work the evidence against me, which was extremely crazy.
Let me help you with that.
Yes. Do you have VLC? Do you have a real player? Why is this keyboard sticky? What have you been watching? And this was surreal, but they tried to stop me. So maybe the last 2 weeks before the military coup, we started to have warnings coming to the network that if you make fun of the president, the network that is broadcasting this will face repercussions. When the military won over, now the whole country is in a state of war. And if you speak up in an environment that is infested by ideas about war and conspiracy, then this is where we started to get pretty much like heat for what we were saying on the show.
You mean while you're filming, Sarah? Are you kind of like going, uh-oh?
You know, the big uh-oh for me was at the beginning where I kind of felt like, what did I get myself into? Because the U.S. government at the time was discouraging Americans from any travel to Egypt that wasn't absolutely necessary. And this wasn't absolutely necessary. It was something I wanted to do. And then, this sounds really cheesy, but I was reading the book Lean In, the Sheryl Sandberg
book. Oh my gosh.
And they say, what would you do if you weren't afraid? And I was like, oh, I would go to Egypt. And Bassem had just been called in for questioning at this time.
Okay. So you started filming in the Morsi era.
I did. And and I ended up teaming up with a guy named Mazyar Bahari, who's an Iranian filmmaker
and
journalist.
Yes, I was going to ask about him in a short time.
Yeah. So Mazyar was already filming. So I ended up using that footage to piece together the story.
Coming up after a short break, Bassem Youssef tells us about the breaking point that forced him to flee Egypt and what his life is like now in America. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Egyptian satirist Bassem Youssef and director Sarah Taxler. Her documentary, Tickling Giants, profiles Youssef as he went from heart surgeon to YouTube comedian to host of a wildly popular satirical news program called The Show. Youssef is often called the John Stewart of Egypt, and certainly Stewart was his idol and inspiration. In return, Stewart has been an advocate of Youssef's satirical work from the very beginning. A year after Youssef first appeared as a guest on Stewart's Daily Show, Stewart did a turn on Youssef's show in Cairo.
Does satire put you, like, gets you into trouble? I mean, what about the love you get from the people?
I'll tell you this, it doesn't get me into the kind of trouble it gets you into. If your regime is not strong enough to handle a joke, then you don't have a regime.
Stewart's words were sadly prescient. Just a month after he appeared on the show, Mohamed Morsi was ousted as president. Eventually, he was replaced by the military-backed Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, a man the New York Times editorial board recently called an enemy of human rights.
So you start to become demonized, really.
Oh, I was the people's enemy number one.
I saw an image skitter past. There's a picture of you, a photograph, and somebody's drawn a Star of David next to your head.
Of course.
Which I assume is a supreme insult.
Well, okay, so in the Middle East, if you want to demonize someone, there's a certain set of accusations that are ready-made. You're Jewish, you're homosexual, you are an atheist, you are a spy. Or you can be the four of them all together.
Right.
With the military, you have all of this, plus being an operative of the CIA and recruited through John Stewart.
Oh, okay. Through John Stewart.
Which I, by default, was also thought
by many
people to be a spy.
You must have been CIA, of course. Yeah. So you bring John Stewart at one point when you're on the air to Egypt.
That was under Morsi.
Under Morsi.
When the popular sentiment was against the Muslim Brotherhood, so they welcomed John Stewart. And a lot of the media that welcomed me bringing a speaker of freedoms of expression started to say, oh, he's with John Stewart. He's a spy. That's when the military took over.
I see.
Yes.
So, but the fact that John Stewart, you know, he's never been bashful about proclaiming that he's a Jew, but people were like, whatever, you're funny. Yeah. We don't care.
He actually said, like, I would never think that, like, a Jewish guy would be greeted that way in the middle of Cairo. He was treated like a king. But the religious people, the pro-Muslim Brotherhood, were actually demonizing him. It's like, oh, he's bringing him, this Jew, whatever. And then, here's the thing. When John Stewart made fun of Sisi, the Muslim Brotherhood loved him. Jew that they hated him. And the pro-Sisi people hated the same Jew they loved him a few months ago when he spoke against Morsi. So here's the thing. I mean, facts and logic and truth doesn't matter. It's the ideology. And this is why when people say, like, how can we reach out?
We have some of that going on right now.
So when people ask me, how do you think we reach across the aisle? You will not. People don't care about the facts. They care about their ideology. And it doesn't matter if Trump does the most horrible thing on air, on camera. It doesn't matter because he's one of us. He's in our team. Sisi said some stuff that is 10 times more stupid than Morsi. And his people who would like torture Morsi, this like it's fine. As long as Sisi said it, it's fine.
When you are getting to the Sisi administration, your network dropped you. And not only dropped you, but then ultimately sued you for a lot of money.
Yeah.
And the basis of the suit was that you had, what, done your job in a way that made it impossible for them to air your show? Is that gist?
Yeah. So, and of course, all of this is political. I mean, we don't have independent legal system. Even the network dropping me is a political decision.
Sure.
Because I was bringing them the biggest ratings in the history of the Arab world. So they dropped the most popular show because at the end of the day, they don't care about the money. They're all part of the one big system.
They're not revenue dependent in
that
way.
Yeah, so they dropped me. Mm-hmm. I stayed unemployed for 4 months until I found a bigger regional network. And at the end of the day, they would bow down to the big and mighty military regime. And I was dropped again by the second network. And then the original network won that lawsuit.
Right, against you.
With $100 million, which at that time was $13 million.
No.
And they know that I don't have that money. And they knew exactly that they were going to use this in order to even put me on a no-fly list or jail me or confiscate my money. So I just had to leave. It took exactly 5 hours from the verdict to me hopping on a plane and leaving the country.
Did you have stuff in boxes? Were you really thinking we're going to have to flee now? I mean, you have a wife and at least one child at that point.
No, when the verdict happened, I just like put whatever I can put in 2 suitcases and I left. So lots of underwear. And and I just left. And my wife actually followed after me with a couple of months. So because at that time, we didn't have that much of a brutal system that would prevent your wife and kid from leaving. It was me. Because they would look bad if they started to target women and children.
Well, didn't you say she actually felt like, which is pretty amazing given the situation, but a lot of people who they knew had ended up in jail. So her feeling was kind of like, well, this is better than that. It's better to have you have to leave.
Of course. You know, you are not the first, Sarah, you mentioned Mazyar Bihari. Mm-hmm.
And he had gotten into a lot of problems in Iran because he had been on done a bit for The Daily Show with Jason Jones, which Jon Stewart felt so terrible about that he grew a beard and made a movie.
I think the beard might have just been a personal style decision. It might have been a guilt
beard. I took
beard.
It as a symptom, yeah.
Yeah, it may have been.
And I mean, I just wonder, this guy fled, encouraged by Jon Stewart, and Monsignor Bahari got detained and tormented. Would there be a hesitancy now to say, you know, let's not do stuff there because these guys got in trouble and put themselves at so much risk? Yeah.
I mean, in my personal opinion, I don't think that what happened to Maziar is because of The Daily Show. I think Maziar is a very accomplished filmmaker and journalist, and this was a thing to hang it on. I mean, obviously, the more strict the country in which you live, the more of a risk it is to do a comedy piece. But I think a lot of people like to be on TV, and that seems to overwhelm a lot of people's fears. So, I mean, Bassem still comes to The Daily Show, and a lot of other people, I think, given the opportunity to have a microphone in comedy, like to do that.
So, Bassem, you're here now. You live in Los Angeles. And what do you do?
So, and if you live here in LA, you have this saying, what do you do in LA? It's like, oh, I'm working on my project. I'm working on my script, which is like another way to say I'm unemployed. But I do have a live show that I take around. It's not regular yet because it's my first season. So I go around colleges. It's a one-man show that I developed. I wrote a book. It's called Revolution for Dummies. And meanwhile, I'm doing a lot of camera auditions that I'm failing at. So, so here I am.
Here you are. And Sarah, were you relieved when he left Egypt?
I felt really torn the last few months of filming because as a fan of what he and his team were doing and as someone who loves satire, I didn't want the show to end because I felt like it represented so much hope for people. But on a personal level, as I became friends with the people there and with Bassem, I just felt like it wasn't good for his health, just mentally and physically. It's too much pressure to feel like your life is on the line in order to tell jokes. And in that way, I did feel kind of relieved once the show was done. But no, I felt heartbroken when they had to leave Egypt.
So at the end of the day, I don't know. It's just not worth getting jailed or tortured for, I guess. It's a hard thing to have to come to that conclusion, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, because it's not just me. It's like there's a whole family behind me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But here you are and you're...
No, I love it here. I mean, it's a new chapter of my life. I dealt psychologically with the fact that I had the biggest show in the Middle East and now it's gone. This kind of like success that came out of nowhere and was like astronomical. And now I'm kind of like trying to start all over again. It is interesting but scary in the same time because you have to start all over again at the age of 43 in a different country, different language, different audience, different references. You know, it's a new beginning. I changed my life like 15 times in the last 5 years. So it goes for the 16th time.
Political satirist Bassem Youssef and Tickling Giants director Sarah Taxler. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.